R.W. Johnson joins us for, well, an update on some rather provocative columns that he's been writing recently. And I'd love to get his insights on what's going on in the Middle East. I loved your column today, Mr. Johnson. It was really, once again, thought-provoking, going through the Communist Party's criticism of the government of national unity. And you explained that it really does put a different perspective on, in addition to the performance of the non-ANC ministers, especially those from the Democratic Alliance, where it does appear as though some of them are doing really well, but one in particular not so well.
Well, I think that obviously John Steenhuisen has a lot on his plate. He's both leader and negotiating with Ramaphosa, and also being a minister, also traveling abroad to China and elsewhere. So it's not really too surprising, but his ministry is clearly in a considerable mess. I think that, If you're a DA minister, especially a white DA minister appointed to that government, the sensible thing, which would appear to be the way that McPherson and Schreiber have behaved, is to roll up and to meet all the people, the civil servants who work in the ministry, and introduce yourself and then talk to them about what needs to be done and what do they see as the main priorities for the ministry and so on and so forth. Now, as we know, Steenhuisen, first of all, brought in Kavanagh, which produced enormous amount of trouble and hostility, not only within his own party, but also, of course, among the black civil servants. And it seems to have triggered a considerable amount of hostility and even sabotage from some of them, because things are not working the way they're supposed to in his department. People haven't been paid for 3 months. He can't get rid of Kavanagh. It's all a big mess. Now, in addition, however, what he's done is he's appointed an all-white office team, some of whom have already got track records of bitter hostility towards the very civil servants they've now got to work with. This is a very foolish thing to have done, but he doesn't seem to have thought about it. And the result seems to be that his ministry must be in a chaotic state. It's not surprising that, you know, McPherson and Schreiber are able to roll out already that they've done this and done that and making progress, and there's no such signs from the Minister of Agriculture. So I think that, you know, he's made some very clumsy mistakes.
Not for the first time.
No, well, look, you know, I think another oddity is that the people that he's appointed are all people who now he has to ask for special dispensation because, like him, they only have matric certificates and they're supposed to have higher qualifications than that for the post they're in. And it seems to be a Steenhuisen tick that he's very conscious of his own educational lack of qualification relatively. And he seems to prefer to appoint other people with the same. But it's only producing more problems.
What does this mean if you look ahead to the leadership of the Democratic Alliance? It does appear as though Steenhuisen has got some very strong ticks. He, for instance, went and got a second-hand Prado to try and show that he wasn't a spendthrift. But on the other hand, his leadership of his own department, if that's not going so well, that can't stand him in terribly good stead when there are others who could stand up to become the next leader of the Democratic Alliance.
Yeah, well, look, it's no secret that Jordan Hill Lewis would be very much the preferred candidate, including against Steenhuisen. I don't think there's any doubt. You just talk to any normal ANC activists or MPs, and that's what you get. I think it would be very unwise of Jordan Hill Lewis to go for the leadership. He's much too young. He's only started a few years ago at Cape Town. He's got an awful lot of that job still to do. It's a job that he loves and that he's very good at, whereas being leader of the DA is a very difficult job, not a particularly pleasant one, and for classically South African reasons, because the DA is by far the most multiracial party. And that means that the leader has got to be continuously sensitive to all the different communities represented by that party. It's relatively easy to be an ANC leader. I mean, you've just got to keep black people happy, and that's how they talk about our people, as they talk. But a DA leader has got... I mean, you could see how disastrous it was that Muzi Maimane clearly had sort of inherited ANC notions about Afrikaans-speaking people and was very dismissive of them and their interests. And this quickly rebounded on, and he lost an enormous number of Afrikaner votes at the next, at the 2019 election, which cost him his job. And you simply cannot afford to behave like that if you're a DA leader. You've got to be very, very sensitive to all these different groups, and keeping them happy is a full-time job.
So what happens, or how important is it to be that the DA leadership is in the hands of someone like Steenhuisen or a Jordan Hill Lewis? How much of a difference would that actually make at the polls?
Well, I think that South African voters, as far as I can see, are very leadership-focused. And they tend to identify parties with their leaders to an extreme degree. I mean, you could see that in the last election where the IFP had Buthelezi, who'd been dead for some while, on their post. quite remarkable, really. But so I do think that, and you would still, I mean, I can remember when I first came out to South Africa that you met people all the time who said, "I'm a smuts man." That was how they identified themselves politically. Not "I'm United Party," but "I'm a smuts man." And they were, yeah, and South Africans very much are looking for leadership. And they're always keen to discover that so-and-so is a really good leader, and then they follow that leader. It goes very deep in the national psyche, this. So I do think that the personal popularity or charisma of particular leaders is important in South Africa. I think that when the DA had Francois Slabbert, for example, it was very noticeable. I mean, he really was, until he threw over the party, enormously popular. And, you know, when he ran for that Rondebosch seat, it was a safe United Party seat, and yet he won it easily. People were really attracted by his charismatic personality. And I think that it does make a difference in that respect. But look, the DA's got 87 MPs. They really ought to have a choice of possible leaders. I mean, there must be a number among them. And one immediately indeed thinks about Cillia Brink. If he's not going to be mayor of Pretoria, he looks like a pretty able and courageous man to me, and someone who ought to be thought of very seriously in that regard.
You've opened that door on Tshwane. What's your reading of the way that it's been handled, in particular by Action SA?
Well, the way that Action SA has behaved is peculiar, and I'm still waiting to see what someone like Athol Trollip would say about this, because he's a very sensible, intelligent man, and he's been very careful in what he says. And I haven't noticed him say anything at all about this, which probably means that he doesn't agree. But I don't know, I'm guessing. Look, I think that Action SA has got itself in a peculiar situation. They've thrown over the DA. They then announce that they're going to provide the next mayor. The ANC immediately says, "No, you're not," and denies that they have an agreement to that regard. I mean, it doesn't look to me like they're very much in charge of events. And I don't know what's going to happen ultimately there. But it does seem to me that Zilla has played a very strong card by saying, "Look, we won't continue with talks to stabilize the metros if you're going to play the game this way. If you want to stabilize the metros, well, you can start with Tshwane. We had a very good mayor in place and putting things to rights. and you're now getting rid of him. I mean, what on earth is going on? And of course, the problem is partly that the Gauteng ANC is obviously a law unto itself.
And how do you think that is going to play out, given the ANC in Gauteng does appear to be flexing its muscles against the national grouping?
Well, it really does depend on whether Ramaphosa will impose his authority, because we all know that although Panyaza Lesufi is a very determined populist, that ultimately the person who is the most influential in controlling the behavior of the Gauteng ANC is Paul Mashatile. So the deputy president is playing a different game than the president. And frankly, the president needs to assert himself.
I guess we will see that happening in the next few weeks. Something else that we'll see happening on a global scale in the next few weeks is developments in the Middle East. They have escalated dramatically in the past few days. How are you reading this?
Well, look, a lot of it has followed a sort of predictable pattern of response and retaliation. But what I'm very struck by is the extent to which the Israelis in particular have planned ahead so that they are actually carrying out moves which they have planned a very long time ago. And I was very struck. It turns out that some while ago, the Israelis approached the Americans and said they wanted 50 F-15, the Strike Eagle, as it's known. And the Americans said, "Why? Come on, that plane first flew in the 1970s. It's old stuff now. Why do you want that?" And they looked at it and they said, "Look, what we want is the Strike Eagle, the latest version, and we want to clear out all of its avionic and electronic equipment, and we want you to supply all the very latest that you've got, and we have got some of our own stuff, and we're going to put that in. And this will revolutionize the capabilities of the aircraft." But the point about it was that the F-15 is very fast, it's Mach 2.5, and it's considerably bigger than the F-16 or the F-18. And it can carry nearly 12 tons of bomb. And it's got a much longer range. It's a two-engine plane, where the other's a single engine. And they had looked at this very hard, and they had decided that there were missions for which they wanted this. Now, they used the F-15, I think a whole squadron of them, for the attack which killed Nasrallah. And they'd worked out that in order to do that, that the bunker was very deep below the building, and that you needed to drop a whole lot of smart bombs, obviously highly directed bombs, in a cumulative way, so that you would not only knock down the floors above, but you would keep on doing that. And altogether, they seem to have dropped something like 80 bombs in a short while. I mean, people reported hearing 8 bangs, but a lot of them must have been simultaneous bangs, if you think of it. Now, the interesting thing to me is they planned that, and they must have trained those pilots, like the Dambuster pilots were trained before their mission. And they'd obviously worked that out a long time ago, and they'd even gone to the point of ordering those planes specifically, and it cost them something like $16 or $18 billion, those planes. So, you know, it's a very big gambit they were making. Now, if you think about it, what other missions have they got in mind for a plane like that, or planes like that, where you've got highly protected targets, which are probably a lot of it underground? And the answer must be Iranian nuclear installation. And to be quite frank, it looks to me, if you saw that film recently, the Tom Cruise film, Maverick, Top Gun, the mission there is clearly to take out an Iranian nuclear facility. They don't call it that in the film, but it's quite obviously what it is. And everything is done as if the opponent is Iran, right down to the fact that they've still got some old F-14s, and Cruz and his friend steal one of them at the end. And it seems to me that they've obviously thought those missions out from years back, and ordered their planes and equipped them and everything. So, I mean, it's very impressive in that sense, you know, the Israeli effort. And, you know, I mean, the whole thing with the pagers and all the rest of it is really quite remarkable. I mean, they not only booby-trapped these pagers, they got Hamas, they got Hezbollah to pay for them, for God's sake. I mean, really extraordinary. Or equally, if you look at the Hamas leader who was killed when he was in Iran, I mean, the thing that's really remarkable about that is he was staying in an Iranian government village of housing provided for foreign dignitary. And the Israelis had placed explosives within that house, God knows how long before, maybe when it was being built. And that's the explosives that killed that guy. So they'd had that laid on for years before. Again, you know, extraordinary, really.
Lots of pre-planning, but what's the end game? How are you seeing that end up now?
Well, I think that American pressure will guarantee that, the more that Israel gets involved in a fight with Iran, the more it needs American support. And I don't think Netanyahu is in a very strong position to keep pushing there. If Biden says, we won't back you, then he's got to back them, because Iran is a very serious opponent. So I think the Americans do have the ability to calm that to some degree. So I expect the Israelis to launch some sort of retaliation, but I don't know how serious it will be. And I think the Americans will then again want them to stop and leave it at that. Which, after all, the main objective of the Israelis is, having dealt with Hamas, to now deal with Hezbollah and to make their own people safe and secure and able to return to their home. They don't have to have a fight with Iran.
But isn't it inevitable that at some point in time, Israel and Iran, given how much they dislike each other, or the leadership at the moment anyway, will come to serious blows?
Well, yes and no. Look, you're talking about a nuclear war. The Israelis have certainly got nuclear weapons, and the Iranians are very close to getting. Now, as we can see with India and Pakistan, when both sides have got nuclear weapons, it's also a good reason not to start anything. And so I don't know that that's really true. I think that the hostility between them is not going to go away, or at least not while that Iranian regime is there. But I think, the other point is this, is that what I think really triggered Hamas on October the 7th and quite likely Iran behind them, was this whole determination led by the Americans to launch a sort of land bridge between India and the Middle East. There's a large Indian expatriate population in the Middle East, and India has a very strong sort of economic reason for further involvement there. And that land bridge, Israel was going to play a crucial part in, and of course it would be very important for the Saudis and the UAE and so forth. And it would inevitably involve recognition of Israel by the Saudis, which was the key to the whole thing. Now, I think that was very much on the point of happening, and that Hamas and Iran wanted to stop that at all costs. I think that the game was beginning to run away from them. So the real question is, once we have got some sort of peace again, however strained and difficult, whether or not that can be resurrected. There will be powerful forces wanting to do so.
Second Level Thinking, as always, R.W. Johnson, the favorite columnist of the BizNews tribe. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.